Don't you just love walking into a restaurant in a town you've never been to and finding it's a place that feels like home away from home? Or at least like grandma's house. Great smells are coming from the kitchen. People at the tables look like they've known each other all their lives. And the menu features comforting food that you might have forgotten about since you were a little kid. And even though you're a stranger, you feel quickly like you belong. But how do you find these great places if you're just passing through town? Well, the two best people I know of for finding comfort food and homey surroundings in the back roads of America are with us again on Travel with Rick Steves. Jane and Michael Stern publish a guide to 800 places for good eats all across the lower 48. Their book's called Road Food, and their roadfood.com website includes an interactive map and a place where you can add your own recommendations to their list. Jane and Michael, thanks for being with us.
Hi, Rick.
Hi, Rick.
What's new with Road Food?
You know, I just have to say, before we even tell you what's new with Road Food, I love the way you introduced the idea of walking into a restaurant, the smells, the sights, the ambiance, the feeling you get of the people, because, you know, a lot of restaurant food critics really focus entirely on the food. You know,
yeah.
Is this, you know, how is this steak? Is it done right? Is it this, that, and the other mm-hmm. thing? And that's all obviously important. But for us especially, road food is defined by the taste of the food, but also just by the whole feel of the place. Is it a local place? Is this the kind of restaurant where the locals come at 5:30 in the morning,
right.
sit around and drink coffee at what they call the Liars Club table,
yeah.
and, you know, catch up with each other? I mean, it's that to me makes a restaurant really delicious, even if the food isn't the best I ever ate.
That's one thing nice about in England now. The pubs have become gastropubs, and pubs specialize in conviviality more than anything else. And for generations, people put up with horrible food because the conviviality was so good. And
right.
it was, but it's not horrible anymore. So you got the same great pub conviviality, and you got the great quality food because you have a new passion, a more affluent society, a society that understands the value of good eating. Do we find that in the United States?
Well, when Michael and I started doing Road Food, which was 1973, is that when we set off? First of all, we had no idea what was out there in the United States. I mean, we had never traveled. We didn't know what we were looking for. And it was scary and it felt lonely to be two people against the entire United States. And in those days, our goal, I mean, if this doesn't sound insane, I don't know what does. Our goal was to review every single restaurant in America. Okay.
Wow.
So we knocked that down a little bit, or we would still have never left Connecticut. What appealed to us in these regional local restaurants, and our beat has always been small town restaurants. We don't do chains. We don't do the big name restaurants. We don't do Escoffier, you know, or the 5-star restaurants. When you walk in and you get that family feeling that even people who don't know you
yeah.
seem to want to know you.
Yeah.
You're kind of wrapped in this warmth that's quite wonderful.
That makes the coffee taste better, you know? It's just nice.
It does make the coffee. And, you know, it's many of these restaurants are especially wonderful in the morning because it is where people come to sort of catch
yeah.
up and get the day started. But we found out there's a whole style of restaurant, primarily in the South, that talk about convivial and talk about friendly and talk about family, what they call round table dining.
Yeah.
A good example of this is the Dinner Bell in Macomb, Mississippi. Round table dining is, there are big tables in the dining room. They're round tables. They seat maybe 10 people. And in the center of the table is a big Lazy Susan. And on that Lazy Susan are set big family-style bowls of fried chicken, mashed potatoes, squash casserole, biscuits, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. When you want something off that Lazy Susan, you spin it, you grab what you want, put your dish back. And that kind of dining, you know, if you're an individual diner or just a couple of diners, it's impossible to dine that way and not start a conversation with the other people. A boarding house reach is perfectly appropriate. And you start talking about the food, and that takes you wherever the conversation goes. That you cannot feel lonely in one of these places.
The boarding house reach. That's a great phrase.
The strangest family feeling I ever had in a restaurant was in Tuba City, Arizona, which is the Navajo reservation. And Michael and I went to a cafe there. Literally nobody spoke English. They were speaking Navajo, which it sounds like Russian backwards.
Right.
It's one of the most difficult languages to learn or understand. And somebody came around selling raffle tickets, and, you know, because we didn't want to seem cheap. We bought a raffle ticket, and we had no idea what the raffle was for. We went back for breakfast the next day, and the owners were hugging us and embracing us, and a little bit of English they spoke. They said, "You won the grand prize." And we said, "What is it?" It was a huge, fully grown sheep that they had in the back of a pickup truck.
Congratulations.
Exactly.
And what were you driving?
We were driving a VW Rabbit at the time.
Stick your sheep in the back.
So we kind of redonated the sheep, but it was a very nice gesture.
But there you go. That's that dimension of fun and eating and good eating that is tied in more with conviviality and being part of that slice of culture. You know, in Germany, they have a wonderful tradition called a Stammtisch.
What is that?
A Stammtisch has a little flag at the table, and it says the name of the club, or it just says Stammtisch. And that's where the locals always sit together. And
wow.
The people who come, they just sit down, and they've always got that conviviality and that round table dining at a Stammtisch.
Oh, how nice.
I've not encountered that in the United States, but the round table dining sounds like a great idea. Talk a little bit more. Where would you find this, where you sit down at a sort of a makeshift family table?
Well, you know, pretty much every small town cafe that is in road food has, if not a revolving table, has a specific table, big table in the middle of the restaurant where all the locals come for breakfast and coffee.
If you're bold, you can join them?
Well, kind
of. We have been invited to join them on occasion.
Yeah, because the Stammtisch is a way to keep the tourists away, to be honest.
Oh, well, our people are a lot friendlier.
That's good.
You want to know how we were asked to join once? Back in the 1980s, before everyone used digital cameras, Michael's father ran a camera store. So even though we were dirt poor, we still had Hasselblads and Rolleiflexes and lights and tripods. We'd go into these little town cafes, and Michael would start setting up lights like he was Cecil DeMille to photograph his cheese sandwich or his apple pie. And the locals would look at him and they'd sort of turn to me and they'd say, "What's he doing?" And it was too hard to explain the concept of road food.
Because this was long before the internet.
Right.
Yeah.
So I said he just was released from a mental hospital and he's harmless, but he loves to take pictures of food. So the locals would invite us over and let Michael take pictures of all their breakfasts, which I thought was quite generous.
What a great idea to break the ice and get to talk with other people.
Act like a lunatic.
A lunatic.
The trouble is that technique wouldn't work today because everyone takes pictures of their food.
Jane and Michael Stern could be called cultural anthropologists of real American cuisine. They're bringing us more of their tips right now on Travel with Rick Steves, tips for finding great food on the back roads and in county seats of America. Their books include their classic guide to eateries called Road Food, as well as The Lexicon of Real American Food and 500 Things to Eat Before It's Too Late. Their website is roadfood.com, and that includes road trip itineraries they recommend for a car trip fueled on the best road food you can find in different regions of the United States. Our phone number is 877-333-7425, and Sid is calling in from Atlanta. Sid, thanks for your call.
Thank you. This is a thrill. The Sterns have been celebrities in this great search we have for authentic food on the highways and byways. So I'm really pleased to be able to ask a question or two. What is it that really makes for authentic road food? Is it the personality behind the counter? Is it the homegrown specialty, or is it just that quick, cheap, and tasty combination of things?
I think it's like, I mean, this sounds corny, but it's sort of like falling in love. I mean, you can go on a very nice date and have a good time and blah, 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 blah. But when all of a sudden, you know, Prince Charming is before your eyes, it's like the music rises and it's like, you know, the angels sing. And when Michael and I go to, you know, the superlative best road food restaurants like the Herring Place
in North Carolina,
right,
yes.
Or the Ploy Festival in Maine, which are foods we never even heard about. and it's all local, and it's completely original and untainted, and it's never been on the Food Network, and the chef isn't a celebrity. I mean, the angels sing.
But, you know, in some ways, I think there is a similarity with the celebrity chef restaurants. I think one of the common denominators of all the restaurants that we think are really quintessential road food is there's a passion there. People mm-hmm. really yeah. love what they're doing, either because it's their tradition or they think it tastes good or it's part of their community, whether this is a barbecue or a fish fry or an oyster roast or a bakery. I mean, there's a sense behind this restaurant that people really care about it. And that, to me, is like the key to great road food.
Yeah, it's almost like obsession, a magnificent obsession.
Is that related to somebody having worked there for a long, long time? It seems like a lot of your favorite places have characters that have been dishing out this or that for 20 years.
Yeah. You know, I'll tell you, this is, I'm sure you have your own little secret tricks, you know, up your sleeve when you travel. When we go to a restaurant and I see the help wanted sign on the window or waitress wanted, we usually turn around and leave.
Yeah.
We found the best places like Eccles Beef on Weck in Buffalo. They have their staff for 40 years. Mary Mac's in Atlanta used to have their staff for 40 years. I mean, the great road food restaurants not only made their patrons feel like family, but their staff was family.
And the staff is a team also.
A yes. team, and they took what they're doing very seriously.
I love that concept. It's so true in my work in Europe to find a place where you know these guys are, they're there for their career. They're not getting yep. rich, but they really believe in what they're doing. They work together with a sort of a silent communication that is just fascinating, and they just keep their people coming back.
And also a lot of our road food restaurants are now third and fourth generation run by families. There was a period in the 1980s when Nouvelle Cuisine came in and Cuisinarts were the thing, and the sons and daughters of the restaurateurs ran away from the restaurants, went to food school, made a bollocked up mess out of the regional food, came back and kind of realized, uh-oh, you know, I did it wrong. Let me see what the way Dad did it. And now they're upholding the tradition.
They're going back to the basics of it, yeah.
Exactly.
Hey, Jane and Michael, I just did a road trip myself from Seattle to Tallahassee, and I took your book along, and whenever I could, I'd look up some of your places. And they were always worth the destination when you wrote highly about some place to find it. But what I found in the southeast of the United States, in areas that are having economic problems, was sort of a rising tide of just, frankly, sad chain restaurants on a corner.
I
You'd
know.
Come to a distant corner. There's no commerce anywhere. You'd have a little commerce around a military base and a little commerce along the freeway. And you come to an intersection, and you got four corners, and you got four chain restaurants.
Absolutely.
And you feel like this whole society is growing up on this uninspired food. Is that something that you notice in poor parts of the country?
Well, we've sort of been noticing it since 1973 when we started.
Yeah.
And, you know, being basic pessimists, which we both are, I think we felt this is the end of the world as we know it, which is now going into its fourth decade. So, yeah.
It is an issue. There's no question. We've seen a lot of really glorious mom and pop restaurants go out of business. Just because there isn't another generation to take over. And
because, it's hard to compete with the Burger King across the
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, Applebee's moved next door or whatever, and you can't compete with it. So, I mean, there's no question that is a big problem. On the other hand, I think one of the things that's happened over the last maybe 15 or 20 or even 30 years is that we Americans have come to really appreciate our regional food. And a lot of, say, barbecues or fish fries that might have just been kind of gone out of business, people who run them realize that they're doing something significant, of cultural significance. And I think in that sense, you know, because these restaurants aren't just places to eat. I mean, they're part of the community. They're where people gather. They're part of tradition. It's the one place you can count on every morning. I mean, because of that, a lot of them, I think, do stay in business despite the onslaught of the chains.
And Sid, what's Sid's take on that? Because, Sid, I was just in Atlanta, and I've never seen a city with less concern for its heritage. You have like three old buildings in the town, right? But you've got restaurants that people have been going to all their life that they're passionate about. What do you see the trend in Atlanta?
Well, I was taking a walk this morning thinking about some of my old haunts that are not here anymore, and I was sad when I thought about those. We are not known for our great historic preservation here, and that's a very significant and sad thing. But we've got some wonderful new things coming on board, like on Buford Highway, just an incredible number of ethnic, wide-ranging ethnic restaurants that is sort of an untapped international scene in Atlanta. So we've got some new frontiers opening up, but we still do miss the Cowan Sandwich Shop that sold golden nugget chicken sandwiches down by the old railroad station, things like that. But one of my other questions to the Stearns would be, what did they see as the new frontiers, if there are any, in road food? I mean, are there going to be bus stations and truck stops?
I hope not.
Well, food trucks, obviously, I mean, is giant in some parts of the country where ordinances allow it. I mean, food trucks are huge. When we started, it was pretty rare to find a food truck in an urban area. Now there's some cities, like, say, Portland, Oregon, where every time you turn around, there's a corner with four food trucks on
it. But I think Sid really said the word du jour, which is ethnic, because Michael and I have gone fairly recently to South Tucson, or I'm just trying to think, in Charleston, the area where it's all soul food restaurants.
Or the Gullah cuisine.
The Gullah cuisine, as one is better than the other. None of these places are famous and none of them are known, but they are pure and they are competitive with each other and they're absolutely delicious.
And I think parallel to sort of the great rise in ethnic food being part of the community is a great rise in really hot, spicy food. I mean, one of the things we've noticed over the years is fried chicken. Well, generally, most of us think of fried chicken as comfort food. In Nashville, there's a whole trend towards what they call hot fried chicken. And when I say hot, I mean ferociously hot. You can get like hot, you get mild, medium hot, and extra hot. And even the hot is almost too hot for us to taste.
Well, it's almost Chinese in that the chicken is fried, like regular Southern fried chicken, and then it's dipped in a boiling pot of Tabasco and other hot sauces and pulled out very quickly. So there's a like almost a candy apple crust
of heat
of the chicken.
Sid, thanks for
Fabulous.
Your call.
Thank you. Good luck.
You bet.
Bye, Sid.
Bye-bye.
Jane and Michael, speaking of hot, what brand of antacid do you carry in your back pocket?
I'm a Nexium girl.
I've been blessed with a stomach made of cast iron. I can eat anything and feel fine.
Nice. Jane and Michael Stern, you guys are busy as ever and to learn what's going on. And you can go to roadfood.com and get up to date on the best places for traditional American food and to celebrate the diversity of our beautiful country. Jane and Michael, thanks and happy eating.
Take care, Rick.
Thank you, Rick.
All that meat and no potatoes just ain't right like green tomatoes. Yes, I'm steaming, I'm really screaming. All that meat and no potatoes.
Next, listeners share how their travels have made a difference in their lives. And they might just have a few ideas to help inspire your next trip overseas. 877-333-7425. That's our phone number. It's Travel with Rick Steves.